Hey there.
Hello, Tim Noah. Even the New Republic's Tim Noah. Hello.
Even the New Republic, and I am this week. I am Even Tim Noah. I have been dubbed by Mickey Kass Even Tim Noah at Even the New Republic. We should probably explain that. The joke is, 20 years old, so it probably requires some explaining. But you are Matt Welch.
Yes, I'm Matt Welch. I'm the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine, which I'm holding aloft.
And nobody ever refers to Even Reason Magazine.
They probably do whenever they're quoting something that we say that's unkind towards Ron Paul, which happens.
That's true. Then you are
only
Even Magazine. And also
when you
write about the joys of socialized medicine.
And, yeah, God, that one's going to dog me till I'm in the grave.
Then you become Even Matt Welch. So yes 20 years ago, to explain the joke, 20 years ago, Mike Kinsley, I think, was the originator of this joke, that so many people were citing the New Republic to defend the Reagan and Bush 1 administrations, that he said they should actually change the name of the magazine to Even the New Republic, because people were always referring to it as Even the New Republic, as in Even the New Republic supports the Contras.
But this also got a revivification, I think, during the run-up and early execution of the Iraq War in 2003, right? Because
yes.
Even the New Republic was vigorously in favor of toppling Saddam once and for all and all of that. And I think since then, the New Republic has been more divided or diverse or something about that particular episode. Although that all predates your joining Even the New Republic, if I'm not.
It does. Although I did work for the New Republic back in the New Republic days of the early 80s. And we'll explain later how I this week became Even Tim Noah. But why don't we start with talking about Rick Santorum, your favorite candidate in the GOP race.
He is an interesting character right now who, as you mentioned to me just before we started, has been now championed by a lot of people who you wouldn't necessarily expect to be fond of him, most notably, from my point of view, David Brooks, the New York Times columnist and author of the great and the terrible doctrine of national greatness conservatism. Even Bill Kristol, his co-author of that piece back in 1997,
right,
in the Weekly Standard, has been saying nice things of Rick Santorum, who is basically the social con candidate. He won, or he tied for first or close second in Iowa. Great little stat from the exit polls. He got 58% of the vote for whom abortion was the number one issue. So he just clearly, all of the social conservative energy went towards Rick Santorum. And now we have this interesting
I'm thinking only 58%?
Yeah. I think that was the highest number of any kind of subset there. The only thing that came close was Ron Paul in the youth vote. The 17 to 24 vote went 50% to Ron Paul, which is a pretty stunning number, too.
Yep.
We can talk about later. But Brooks had a column, I think, just today talking about Santorum that started off with, well, I disagree with Rick Santorum about these half a dozen things. But he's great because he recognizes that rampant individualism is the problem. And this is, I think, especially from the libertarian point of view, but not only, it's a great comment, not even on Rick Santorum, but on David Brooks and neoconservatism in general. Part of that project from the beginning has always been a hostility to the idea of social libertarianism, the kind that Reason Magazine loves and champions. They want to use government as a tool to kind of restore morality and stop or check this rampant kind of individualistic, egotistical ethos that is wrecking American society. I think they're wrong with that, needless to say, and it's more, to me, just interesting in how desperate the Anyone But Mitt Romney campaign has gotten to, where now neoconservatives, who were originally supposed to be kind of social moderates who had an aggressive foreign policy, now are making nice with social cons because they are so desperate to have anyone not named Mitt Romney be someone who is also not named Ron Paul.
Right, right. Well, we are definitely seeing the strange new respect phase of the Santorum campaign. It began on Tuesday, and it will end next Tuesday, right?
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, it's just like they fired a gun and say, okay, we got to go through the whole cycle now. First we build him up, then we talk about what a sleazebag he is, then we completely deflate him, and then we leave him for dead on Tuesday. Didn't you get the memo from the media conspiracy on this?
Yeah, no kidding. No, I wasn't on Journalist.
I am not, nor have I ever been.
Have you been on the? Are you on the successor to Journalist?
Do those things. Yeah. I don't. My feeling is, I'm a blogger. I don't want to be in the business of giving away my best ideas to a bunch of people who aren't paying me for them.
There you go.
Although I am doing blogging heads, so go figure. But there's this strange new respect phase, and David Brooks is kind of doing his Philosopher King bit about Rick Santorum, and he kind of has to do the Philosopher King bit with Santorum, because when you really get down to the nitty-gritty of Santorum's beliefs, I think Brooks, deep down, finds them repulsive. There is a notable insincerity to these strange new respect columns that we're seeing. Another one today by Charles Krauthammer actually prompted me to tweet a plea to the space aliens who have captured Charles and urging them to bring back the Charles that I know, who I believe cannot stand the sight of Rick Santorum.
What do you attribute this to? I mean, is it trying to kind of put lipstick on a pig, or what's your sense of the motivation?
I think part of it is everybody's figuring, well, you know, it's just a week. What the hell? if we're going to do it, we better do it now, because we sure as heck aren't going to do it after the New Hampshire primary. I think that's part of it. And I think part of it also, you know, sort of opinion abhors a vacuum, just like everything else. And I think part of it, I think you're right. You make a good point of it. So the neocons are very anxious about Mitt Romney. They tend not to do too well with moderates, neocons. The only quote-unquote moderate they did well with, they managed to seduce, was George W. Bush. And that's partly because he turned out to be a lot less moderate than he appeared during the election.
And also, the intellectual history of that is that he was not the neocons candidate. He was, I mean, John McCain was
right. Kind
of the perfect embodiment of what they were after. He became a neocon.
They didn't like
president.
Him. During the campaign, he dissed the whole idea of nation building, which was anathema to them. But then they seduced him.
He became neoconservative after 9/11 by necessity, because they had a ready doctrine or set of beliefs or whatever, a policy program that you could plug and play into the new atmosphere. And
there's also a sort of, I think, a not insignificant psychohistory component to that, which was that they played to his Oedipal instincts regarding his father. This is nicely documented by Jacob Weisberg in his book. I forget what his book is called. He wrote a book about George W. Bush that was largely about this, and it's one of those things that sounds pathetically simplistic when you say it out loud, but there's a remarkable amount of circumstantial evidence for it, not least of which is that the Bush family for several generations has been has had kind of Oedipal tendencies. I actually wrote a piece, got a good 20 years ago, about George H.W. Bush's weird Oedipal feelings towards his own father, who was a U.S. senator. There were unique circumstances there that do not pertain in this instance. Although Republican candidate who is the son of a prominent Republican politician, but there seems to be there doesn't seem to be an Oedipal component here, as best we can tell. Mitt Romney adored his father, continues to adore his father.
Well, you know, tell it to Maureen Dowd, pal, because she had a column today, yesterday, this week, sometime, saying that everything is all about Oedipus, and her Mitt Romney take on it was that he wants to avoid the fate of his father, who I'm getting this right, from her point of view, wrecked his political career by saying that he'd been brainwashed in Vietnam, and so therefore Mitt is overcompensating by never saying anything that is interesting to anybody.
I think that's a reach. I think he's just operating in a different political environment and behaving opportunistically. And one thing we know about Mitt Romney is he is an opportunist.
Sorry to step on your line. I think the difference between him and his father is that his father was a real kind of CEO type. And even though Romney has been CEO, I think he's CEO of Bain Capital, as well as I think the founder of it, he is really a management consultant type. And those two things are hugely, hugely different. Even though you're still in the executive suite, you're still next to the deciders and all this kind of stuff. But there's such a difference between kind of going into an organization and saying it in a way that's palatable to the organization. Here's how I'm going to break down your existing problems, and try to kind of sell it to you first and then sell it to your customers next. That's just sort of different than being a semi-swashbuckling, shoot-from-the-hip type of entrepreneur type.
But right, and kind of two interesting points to make about George Romney. One is I only recently learned by reading Jeffrey Cabaservice's very good new book, the title of which I have also forgotten. I am the worst book plugger who ever drew breath. Jeffrey Cabaservice has a very good new book about moderate Republicans, which I actually have a review of in the Sunday New York Times that I believe by the time this is posted should be available online. Two things. One is that the brainwashing comment, Romney's brainwashing comment, he was actually repeating something that had been in the Detroit Free Press.
Oh, that's great.
They had said, God, I don't know what happened to Romney when he first went to Vietnam and he spouted all this stuff that the generals were saying. He must have been brainwashed or something. So he was actually brainwashed by the Detroit Free Press. That's interesting fact number one. Interesting fact number two is that Cabaservice says in his book, the thesis of Cabaservice's book is that moderate Republicanism, which of course, you know, its high water mark was the Eisenhower administration, which most contemporary Republicans would like to forget because it doesn't conform to any contemporary notions of what a Republican should be. But anyway, that brand of moderate / liberal Republicanism did not die in 1964, that's the way the narrative usually goes, is that it was sort of strangled to death by William F. Buckley and Barry Goldwater, and Goldwater lost in 64, but like a phoenix from the ashes rose Ronald Reagan. Cabaservice says that's not quite what happened. Yes, eventually Reagan took power, but for the rest of the 60s and much of the 70s, moderate Republicanism remained a force in American politics.
Well, having not read the book, I can make an argument, perhaps, that it's impossible to imagine that having lived through any of it, but that on paper you could argue that Richard Nixon was a moderate Republican.
And Cabaservice does. And in fact, Cabaservice basically says that for the first couple of years, Nixon really was a moderate Republican, and even after he stopped being, after he decided that he hated moderate Republicans, he continued for opportunistic reasons to continue to promote policies that certainly by today's standards would have to be called moderate. But anyway, this is all a long wind-up to my saying that Cabaservice concludes, and I think this will probably get some attention, he says that when Romney actually had a real shot at getting the nomination in 68. He was way up in the polls. Very early on, I think like in 67. And of course it all went poof with the brainwashing comment. But Cabaservice says that when the Romney candidacy in 68 went belly up, that was the last chance, he thinks, for real moderate Republicans to assume the presidency, which is interesting, obviously, in light of the fact that, you know, the father of Obamacare is likely to be the Republican nominee.
Yeah, which itself is just an insane paradox, I think. I wrote about this at CNN.com this week. I mean, after 3.5 years, whatever it's been, however you want to count it, basically since TARP, since September 2008, almost all of American politics since then, the action in American politics has been going in one direction. I mean, the growth of the Tea Party out of nothing, early opposition to TARP, which was an interesting sort of populist spasm. You know, Scott Brown winning the May 2009 California special election, which people have forgotten, but there's, you know, the political class said, okay, this is finally the way that we're going to solve this problem forever. You just got to raise these taxes, do this. And it was, you know, rejected by an average of 30 percentage points, the whole thing. All of these signs, boom, 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 the midterms in 2010, have pointed in the direction, at least on the Republican side, the right side of the spectrum, that there's a lot of kind of anti-big government ethos out there. For the first time in a long time, I mean, Republicans talk about limited government, but they don't actually do anything about it in practice, and it's been more, you know, the glories of Ronald Reagan and free enterprise and blah, 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 but really not about cutting anything. So you finally now have a moment out there where people are into, you know, cutting. They want to hear about what your hard cuts are going to be. And at that moment of all times in the universe, Republicans are about to nominate a guy who created the model for Obamacare, the single most hated piece of legislation that he's passed, who argued, despite lying about it several times since then, but who argued on the 2008 campaign that, yeah, this is a model that the rest of the country should use, and who has never to this day really come. I mean, he's running against Obama, complaining that Obama has cut Medicare. I mean, he's not going on some kind of radical program. He doesn't have any real program to reduce spending. So after all this time, this is the guy that you're going to choose. It's really curious and kind of emblematic of the strange and topsy-turvy political world that it's felt like we've lived in, especially in the last half decade or so, where things just kind of don't make sense and they change so quickly. We were talking about Santorum going in. What was he polling at 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago? And in Iowa, it was like 6% or 5%. Stuff moves really quickly. And I think that Romney has a under-acknowledged ceiling of support out there because he is not liked among the Tea Party. He polls very badly among Tea Party supporters. He polls very badly among people who want to elect someone who they describe as conservative. He gets the highest numbers of people who say that they have reservations for about the guy that they're voting for. I mean, his whole notion is based on electability because he's presentable. You can take him home and introduce him to Ma while you're having a fling with the guy on the other side. But if that shroud of electability or whatever begins to, however you come out of my mixed metaphor, then he's in a lot of trouble. I still think he's going to glide to the nomination, probably. But it's just so odd that after all of this time, Republicans are not going to probably choose someone who is actually in the zeitgeist of that moment, which has a lot of energy and enthusiasm, but instead is choosing someone who is really just repackaging George W. Bush's big government conservatism, which is anathema to all these people. So it's curious.
Yes, but let me just sort of say, yes, when you're talking about where the energy is in the Republican Party, I think you're right. But I would make some caveats. One is that the polls about covering certainly what's been going on in Congress suggest that there is a gap between the kind of anti-government agenda, which is now dominant among congressional Republicans, and Republican voters. They are not as anti-government by a long shot as their representatives, particularly in the House, are. And that needs to be remembered. I would argue that actually Romney represents, if not a majority of Republican opinion, a plurality, at least in comparison to the other candidates. He is, I think, in most of his policies, he is more in line with the Republican mainstream as measured by sort of polls of voters. The other thing is we also have to sort of look at the fringe with we have to make some caveats there too. The Tea Party is not anti-government. The Tea Party is anti-government for anybody except old people. That's an important distinction. The Tea Party is principally a lot of old people who do not want to give up their Social Security and do not want to give up their Medicare, but they don't think that anybody else besides them deserves government benefits. Would you agree with that proposition?
I think it's more complicated than that. I think there's certainly grains of truth in the sense that it's unclear what the position on Medicare and Social Security and also military spending, I think, is up in the air. You have people like Rand Paul, who is the first really explicitly Tea Party senator, or one of the first classes. He has argued, trying to make his wish come true more than anything else, but that the Tea Party actually does want to take on entitlements and military spending, and he's backed that up with the way he's acting in office. But I think the jury is still out on how focused people are. I mean,
as I'm recommending books whose titles I can't remember, the other book I reviewed in that same review where I review the Cabra Service is Theda Skocpol's new book about the Tea Party, which is really good, and it's the first book I've seen on the Tea Party that really does give you some actual, she's a real sociologist. There are actual she's managed to back her assertions up with both shoe leather reporting and statistical evidence.
I'll just cut in with a couple of things and let you keep talking. Mm-hmm. Our polling director, Emily Eakins, about a year ago did a poll of sampling a Tea Party opinion, and she came to the basic conclusion, and I'm sure I'm mangling this somehow, but that about half were focused on ideas that you could describe as certainly fiscally libertarian, and the other half were more kind of traditional Republican as it is now, which isn't at all necessarily libertarian. And then another thing that I would point people to look at is the Tea Party's document, The Contract from America, which is a pretty interesting kind of process by which they came up with it. But it's a bullet point list of 10 things. And it really is about government. It's not necessarily about Medicare, but it's about government as opposed to the traditional, last 20, 30 years worth of Republican talking about taxes. Instead, it's about government encroachment, the size of it, the size of debts and deficits.
I'll agree with this. I think they're targeted libertarians. I think they are incomplete libertarians.
I would say more like there are libertarian goals among a movement that itself is not libertarian.
Interestingly, one interesting finding Skocpol has, she cites a poll in, I think it was South Dakota, among Tea Partiers there. They were not particularly hostile to the idea of a millionaire surtax. Again, because they are driven largely by their own, identity as a group. There aren't very many millionaires among the Tea Partiers, so their thinking is if you want to tax people who make more money than we do, go ahead, just don't tax us. So it's a complicated picture. Now let's talk about, but while we're talking about these subgroups, explain to me these youthful Ron Paul supporters who are willing to ignore all the good reporting initially done by the New Republic and subsequently done by Reason 4 years ago about these pretty appalling newsletters that went out under Ron Paul's name, newsletters that were really seriously anti-Semitic, racist, homophobic, vile, and
stupid. I mean, just stupid. You get the sense of kind of monkeys, apes typing with their elbows. I mean, it is appalling how dumb they are. Yeah.
And part of, I guess, the strategy of Murray Rothbard is to reach out to, deliberately reach out to rednecks by appealing to their prejudices. It was a fairly hateful business, and to a remarkable degree, Paul has not had to answer for them. To the extent that he has given out inconsistent statements over the years. And it is simply not credible to me that statements like this would have been going out under his name and he would have been unaware of it. Apparently he didn't write them, or certainly didn't write most of them, but it's just not possible he wouldn't be aware of them.
I'll answer the first part of your question first, because partly because it's easier.
Yep.
But you know, why do young people like Ron Paul, even though this odious history is with us, baggage comes a part of him? I think the answer to that is easy to understand, which is that this stuff isn't part of his campaign. He's not out there campaigning against Martin Luther King. He's not talking about, you know, how to prevent the animals from coming into your house, you know, and renaming New York Zoopolis. This is the opposite to the themes and the discussions of his campaign, and of the themes and the discussions of his supporters and the people and the kind of movement that's grown up around him. So if he can't
libertarianism, in fact, is supposed to stand for, I mean, you don't expect libertarians to be bigots. You expect them to be very broad-minded.
David Bowes from the Cato Institute says, as part of his kind of snapshot definition of libertarianism, is that social tolerance is the highest virtue, or among the highest virtues.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with that. That is part of the conception, is really live and let live, that you
right,
don't...
I'm hard-pressed to name any homophobic libertarians. It's just not a social type I'm familiar with. But
right. But I mean, one part of that is that what libertarians were talking about, you know, 25 years ago, much like what Americans were talking about 25 years ago, is different. And the generation that comes with that is different, too. So,
you know, 25 years ago wasn't, I have to say, people are overdoing this business about some more like 20 years ago, right? And you know,
oh, I mean, no, some of the bad writing was 1994. I mean,
yeah.
17 years ago. I'm talking
more
about generations.
I remember 1994. All of that stuff was way, way over the line back in.
Oh yeah, no, I'm not defending any of it. I mean, I wrote my first editor's note in Reason magazine was called Ron Paul's Mistake, and it was about this. You know,
I mean, to find stuff like that, you really have to go back to the Birchers of the '60s, when there was even a subculture where that was in the mainstream.
Yeah, and the to me, what's fascinating about this on a thousand different levels is that this. Certainly this kind of excretion of this part of the paleo-libertarian strategy, as it was called, was, or is even, a disaster. I mean, it didn't work. There wasn't like this groundswell of people going, yeah, you know what I really need is some smarty pants with a background in Austrian economics to really connect with me about how much I resent, the animals in inner cities who are all probably criminals anyways. I mean, it didn't catch. It didn't take off.
One can think of certain Austrians who would have been sympathetic to that idea,
yeah.
but not the ones we're talking about.
So I think, I mean, it probably did hurt him a little bit in Iowa. I mean, the people who made their decisions in the last week or two, when Paul had been a semi-frontrunner and was taking a lot of heat on this, those people did not vote for Ron Paul. He did very poorly among that subgroup. So I think it did reduce his support, and it was probably part of it. But ultimately, despite the fact that this stuff went out under his name, and it was sometimes even written in the first person, it doesn't sound anything like him. I mean, I'm confident that he didn't write those things, and it doesn't connect to what he's talking about today. So I think people who support him and are young and who aren't racist, which is basically his supporter, they can't feel it in that same way. But let's not forget another element to all of this.
Mm-hmm.
He is so different than anybody who's running for high office. He speaks to people in terms of direct policies, in, for instance, being in, you know, steadfastly in opposition of the drug war, of being so strongly anti-interventionist in a way that we haven't seen a major party presidential candidate in a hell of a long time. On issue after issue like this, he speaks to someone who's upsetting the status quo and in a way that is totally attractive and congruent with young voters. So, you know, when you're making that kind of value proposition, okay, there is these awful things that was written under his name and that he profited from one way or the other 17 to 23 years ago, or whatever the time band was, on one hand, and that looked nothing like this thing that I know today on this hand. And so you're going to make a snap value judgment and say, hey, look, you know what? The drug war is actually racist today, and Barack Obama supports it, even though he came into office saying that he was, you know, in at least qualified opposition to it. So what is going to be more important at the end of the day? I think that explains the kind of the dissonance that you detect. And then just to quickly get into...
But can I interrupt? Can I interrupt, though? If you're a cafeteria libertarian and you like the... You like the foreign policy, but you don't like the domestic policy. Ron Paul really isn't your guy. I mean, there's this weird phenomenon. Actually, a lot of lefties have kind of thrown in with Ron Paul, at least in some notional way. I think they're all going to end up voting for Obama. But Katha Pollitt had a terrific column, I don't know if you saw it, sort of taking Robert Scheer and a number of other lefties to task for praising Paul. And, you know, she basically said the left should have no truck with this guy. And I have to say, even if you forget about the newsletter business, it's still true that the left should have no truck with this guy. The left is not about libertarianism. And it's weird for them to behave as though it is.
Well, it's not weird, I don't think, to make that argument. I mean, on the other side, you had Scheer and you have people like Glenn Greenwald. You know, for 6 to 8 years, mostly six, we heard a steady diet from the left side of the commentariat that arguably the most pressing issues in America was the Bush administration's expansions of executive power, its expansions of the surveillance state, its disregard for constitutional liberties, its promiscuous use of the American military war machine. It's lowering the bar for intervention abroad. These weren't just issues. These were the most important issues, posited to us again and again and again for 6 years. And I think Glenn Greenwald is right to say, if those were your most important issues truly, or if you, like, you know, crazy libertarians think that the drug war is an appalling thing, too. You add that to that list. If those are truly your most important issues, if you elevate those things up there, it's a little bit premature just to say, oh, I can't cross that bridge with this guy because he wants to eliminate the Department of Education and Commerce. And I agree with that.
Do you think these are the preeminent issues right now?
Sure. I mean, for me, the biggest issues are that that we are heading over a fiscal cliff, or at least we're, you know, halfway over it now.
Part of that certainly is military
spending. Medicare is hanging over our heads in a way that no one is taking seriously. But also, to have the opportunity to have someone who is against a system right now where we're arresting 800,000 people a year for what they do privately in their own home, that to me is a more important issue almost than anything.
You're dodging the question. Do you think that Robert Scheer's favorite libertarian issues are the preeminent ones of this era?
American military spending and American military presence abroad.
Yeah, foreign policy issues, basically.
Foreign policies, in many ways, yeah, sure. Of course it is. I mean, we spend 46% of the world's money on defense. There is this bipartisan, I mean, you were praising Eisenhower earlier, and one of the reasons I'm guessing that you praise Eisenhower is that he was an early and prescient critic of all of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This is part of what we can't afford, and I think it also kind of inhibits the world. The idea that America must always retain its preeminent status and control the world's shipping lanes and all this kind of stuff for commerce, I think, is an inhibition on our own country and on the world, even if we're acting in only the best interests and in the most benevolent way possible. I think it puts a bigger target on our back. It
more important than the economy?
Ultimately, it's part and parcel of the economy. Sure, sure. Mm-hmm. And I mean, Scheer's been talking about this. He's a good friend of mine. He's been talking about that particular thing for 40 years. So it's not like he's suddenly, being inconsistent. I think the thing that's new for him is the Federal Reserve part of it. Mm-hmm. But you know, if you believe that the Federal Reserve is at the heart of or near the heart of the economic crisis, sure, you're going to be more interested in a guy who wants to audit the thing. He might want to end it too, but he's not going to be able to do that. So I don't think it's ideologically inconsistent for Bob Scheer at all. He once told me, he was in his office a couple years ago, and I interviewed him, and he said, look, you can have half of the federal departments. You can get rid of them overnight if, in return, you can bring our troops home and cut military spending in half. That's what he told me two, 3 years ago here. He's been consistent on that for a long time. So it makes sense if you're elevating that issue.
Let the record show that I'm not willing to sign on to that deal.
And that's understandable. I think what Greenwald is talking about, and he's right, is, instead of preempting conversation by saying, he's just beyond the pale, crazy Looney Tunes guy, acknowledge where he is not just good on issues that you at various times hold dear and talk about are important, but that he's the only good one out there, almost in the field of American politics, and that the president that you're going to vote for is not so good on those issues at all. I think doing that with your eyes open is much more intellectually credible. And again, I say this as someone who I don't begrudge anyone for not voting or choosing not to vote for anyone or any candidate, or who conclude, for example, that the fact of these newsletters I can't cross that line with a guy. I don't begrudge anyone that decision, but I think there is an opportunity. It is interesting that this fight is happening right now on the left. Only during the first primary season of the Republican Party, it almost calls it suggests why is this happening right now? Why is it important to make sure that no one gives strange new respect to Ron Paul among the liberal and progressive side right now?
Oh, sorry, was that a question?
Yeah, no, it was sort of a rhetorical ending of my stem winder.
Sorry, my mind was drifting over to the fact that we have limited time. We should probably
I want to get to your recess appointment. Another big issue besides the Iowa elections and New Hampshire ones coming up, where Romney is going to stomp, but from my perspective, hopefully Paul comes in second. Our recess appointments and all this kind of stuff. You had a good piece up this week about that. For those of us whose eyes glaze over at filibustering and constitutional tussles between the two parties that shift sides whenever the other one's in power. Walk us through it and tell us why you think what you think.
Well, we have had a problem for quite some time. I think everybody would agree. Maybe you don't. I don't know. But certainly I've had a problem with the fact that the Republican Congress has been pursuing what's been termed a nullification strategy, where if they can't, for example, repeal Dodd-Frank, they will starve the regulatory agencies that enforce it. They've also been blocking all sorts of appointments, most notably the head of the new Consumer Financial Agency. This has been very frustrating to the president. And 2 days ago, several days ago, I should say, he made a recess appointment. He installed the head of the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and he also installed three members of the National Labor Relations Board. In both instances, these were bodies that literally could not function without appointees, and that was his justification. The problem for me is that he did it. He made a recess appointment when the Senate was not by its lights, anyway, in recess. You get into all sorts of technical questions here about what a recess is and what isn't, but I think the simple fact is that the Senate, basically because it was hostage not only to the Senate Republicans, but also, weirdly, House Republicans for complicated technical reasons that we don't need to get into, the Senate, knowing that Obama wanted to make these recess appointments, blocked it. And they blocked it by not going into a formal recess when they all went home for Christmas. Instead, they went through the formalities of remaining in session by gaveling every 3 days. And so the Senate says it's not in recess, and yet the president makes recess appointments. That's a real problem. That's a constitutional problem. Now, I wholeheartedly agree with the Obama administration when they say that that the Congress is playing games. Although, to be fair, these are games that the Democrats were playing against Republicans when the shoe was on the other foot. But they have taken it to new extremes. They have pursued it specifically to try and render government agencies non-functional, and that part really is new. But I don't think the president has the power independently to decide when the Senate is in recess and when it's not. Now, I wrote in my initial post, and I was wrong about one thing. I said, you know, why did he do this? He could have done this the day before when there was a parliamentary changeover from the first session to the second session of the Senate. He could have slipped them through during the brief moment in between these two sessions. Teddy Roosevelt did much the same thing when he had a similar problem. And I was wrong about that, because that what I didn't know was that that too had been booby-trapped so that there was no gap. Anticipating a Teddy Roosevelt-like maneuver, the Republicans had fixed it so that the first session actually extended into the second session, so there was no moment when the Senate wasn't in session. I thought that there was a more reasonable alternative for Obama, and I was wrong about that. There wasn't a more reasonable alternative. Still, what he did, I think, is not really constitutional. Now, it's probably equally true that when Congress denies the president the power to make recess appointments, that is also not constitutional. The Constitution says the president is allowed to make appointments during Senate recesses. That does presuppose that there will be Senate recesses. So you've got a real problem here. Today, on the New Republic's webpage, I co-authored a piece with Akil Amar of Yale Law School, proposing a fix, a patch, as we say in the tech world, where since the Democrats control the Senate, if the president can get Harry Reid to not act in an official way, but unofficially collect 51 signatures from the Senate under a letter that basically concurs with the president's action, and comes up with some explanation or justification for it, which it can make as vague or as specific as it likes, that would be a kind of a fix that I think would make this problem go away, because the precedents here are not court precedents. The courts have actually not typically gotten involved in this except in kind of indirect ways. The way this has been governed in the past has been through informal agreements between the Senate and the executive. So while absent such an agreement, I really do think it's unconstitutional. Akil, I think, would not use that term, but I think he would say it's not good. sort of absent that, it's not legitimate. But if you had some evidence that the Senate, the majority of the Senate, consented to this view of the situation, then that would, I think, solve the problem.
I guess taking the broader view of things, maybe here. You mentioned, Teddy Roosevelt's maneuver for many libertarians, and not just, Glenn Beck fans out there. The word Teddy Roosevelt maneuver does not fill your heart with gladness.
Famous socialist.
I know
you don't think he's a socialist, right?
No, the power of the presidency, our modern notion of the imperial presidency, basically starts with Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, and then kind of has gone on from there. And so anytime the president is, I'm generally against presidents acting unconstitutionally, even if we're talking about some absolutely kind of, dead boring the parliamentary mechanism that no one actually really cares about too much outside of 16th Street. Here in Washington, the world's eyes glaze over it, that kind of stuff. But the president should act in the Constitution. Obviously, the Constitution was written in a way so that it would restrain the various competing branches of power. And I think it's equally as obvious, although it's more contentious, that it has tipped way too strongly in the direction of the executive branch for a really long time. And so that always fills you with dread. And then just kind of thinking about where we are right now in the Obama presidency, take the kind of constitutional value judgment aside, I think the context for this is that presidents, especially as they erode, their majorities kind of erode in Congress, they stop thinking as in terms of legislation and start thinking much more about governing through their regulatory agencies, and it's kind of a natural battlefield for Congress to try to gum that up and to fight over that. And that's where Obama probably, I think through his second term, which I would bet that he will get, I think that he's going to be spending a lot of his energy there in places like the EPA and the FCC.
But government paralysis, just to be clear, government paralysis, one thing about being a libertarian is that government paralysis is not especially distasteful if you're a libertarian, right?
That is correct, sir. How long has Belgium gone without a government? And I'm not
right.
Sure any of the citizens have yet noticed. I think the political realities of government paralysis are that Americans end up hating both political parties, which to me is a solution, not a problem.
But there are real-world consequences as well, that the government doesn't perform functions. In the case of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, that consumer protections, which you may or may not agree with, but they are not attempted. National Labor Relations Board is already a fairly toothless agency because of previous legislation hampering it. It is rendered not just toothless, but entirely non-functional. If you happen to believe that there is a role for the government in regulating the way businesses treat unions, as I do, then it actually is a problem when the NLRB is not open for business.
Yeah, I guess the NLRB, for the most part, has the only headlines that it's made, other than right now, over the last couple of years, was its opposition to Boeing in a way that didn't strike me as particularly useful or helpful to anyone. So yeah, the libertarian cynic does not shed too many tears that for a few moments the federal regulatory apparatus is slowed down somewhat. There are worse outcomes in the world. All of that said, if we are to have a government, it should function, I suppose. This, if anything, is a case study of why you want to politicize as little as much as possible in our human life. And we have over-politicized, and overregulated so many different things that it's inevitable that all these things become political contests in areas where they really kind of shouldn't be. I think the ultimate solution to that is picking and choosing more wisely about what government should and should not do, which I don't think has been a kind of conversation that anyone's really had in a long time. And that hopefully we'll be having soon and as part of the 2012 presidential campaign, since, again, you know, we're going over a fiscal cliff, so we need to be figuring out what pretty things we are going to be able to live without, because we just simply can't afford what we have right now. And speaking of can't afford, we're out of time as well. So, Tim Noah, thank you. It was great
Matt,
fun.
Always a pleasure.
And hopefully talk to you soon.
Yep. Okay, great. Thanks.
Okay. Bye-bye.